From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Today, a jury of 7 women and 5 men, after weeks of testimony and sifting through a mountain of email and recorded evidence, found all 4 defendants in the ComEd 4 trial guilty on all counts. The 4 defendants are former CEO Ann Pramaggiore, former ComEd lobbyist Mike McLean, former ComEd executive John Hooker, and former ComEd consultant and City Club of Chicago president Jay Doherty.
This case was about corruption, broad in scope, spanning a period of close to a decade. The criminal conduct in this case was undertaken with corrupt intent to enrich ComEd and to benefit the Speaker of the House and his associates.
We think that all in all, they're good people that made bad decisions. The argument that the defense did very well to try to prove that this was all in the normal course of business did not sit well with us.
That is one of the jurors who served on the Commonwealth Edison bribery trial. Her name, Amanda Schnitker Sayers. We also heard from the acting U.S. attorney, Morris Pasquale. The verdict is in on all counts guilty. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. And also with us, we have Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And we will also be joined today now by Chicago Tribune's Ray Long. Not only did he cover the trial, he wrote the book, The House That Madigan Built. And Ray, it's always good to have you back with us as well.
Always good to be here, Sean. And you know, Charlie wrote the foreword to that book, so you know it's worth reading just for that.
Exactly, exactly. Ray, I'll start off by asking your thoughts, because you were at the trial and you sat through it all the weeks that this occurred and the verdict. You were there that day to get your thoughts on what took place. Any surprises?
Well, I was more surprised when I heard all the evidence that some of these people didn't plead out it in the beginning. There was a huge amount of information coming out every day. I felt like my partner, Jason Meisner, the regular federal courts reporter, and I were running around with tin cans trying to catch a waterfall of information, John. And there was a clear reason for the jury to come out with the verdicts they did. I know that there was a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of people saying, oh my goodness, this is just business as usual, or this is how lobbying is done. But that's not really the case when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it. At least that's the thought of the jury. And one of the big questions here is, well, what about these people who were put on the ComEd payroll through lobbyists? And one of the examples there is, this is not a typical bribe situation where you put money in a bag and hand it off, but rather it is a situation where ComEd, because Madigan allegedly wanted it, ComEd put people that were Madigan allies, precinct captains, former aldermen, on a contract, a subcontract of a lobbyist who didn't always list these people on the contracts that they signed. And ComEd would pay the regular lobbyist, in this case is Jay Doherty, and then they would, the lobbyist, Jay Doherty, for example, would then pay the aldermen and precinct captains for jobs that didn't require any work. And so they did this because Madigan wanted it. And that is the conclusion that the jury came to, that they were attempting to bribe Madigan, not just keep him happy, but attempting to get him to look favorably upon their legislation. The defense said, well, this is great legislation and a great law, and you can argue clearly that there was a benefit to some of the bills that they passed during this 10-year period that was in question from 2011 to approximately 2019, less than 10 years, actually. But you can argue that ComEd came up with a new infrastructure that makes their service better, et cetera. And they also got a very lucrative formula rate that was arguably one that might not have been as good as it should have been. Now, excuse me, there's kids running around in back of me. I'm on Navy Pier right here as I talk. A lot of these folks have just determined that it was wrong, it violated the law, and you did not need this direct quid pro quo that everybody who is not paying attention to the trial and the directions or the law itself point to. So when you saw it, the verdicts to anyone watching it, like me, I watched it every day, it was not a surprise. I thought it was a narrow case, and it's always a jump ball when it goes to a jury, but I was not surprised that they came out with verdicts of guilty on all counts.
Well, Charlie, you and I have talked about this for several weeks with guests on the show, and we were not in the courtroom. Of course, we did not hear every single piece of evidence as it was presented, but you and I have discussed this before. What were you surprised by what it turned out to be?
I guess I was a little surprised in that I thought the argument that there was actually no exchange of money between the defendants and Madigan himself, I thought that might have had more sway. And I'm pretty sure, and Ray, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think Judge Leinenweber suggested that there are other circuits, and we're in the Seventh Circuit here, there are other circuits where justices have come to the conclusion that it is no quid pro quo unless money changes hands. And so one of the things that the U.S. attorney said after the verdict, Morris Pasquale, he said the bribery wasn't about cash flowing to Madigan, rather a more intangible benefit, increased political capital. And this is a quote from, this was not the $100 or the $10,000 in a grocery bag at the back room. It was much more complex. The dollar amounts involved and the gain involved was much more significant as well. So it's a different type of bribery case.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. This is not your typical alderman or judge taking a bag of cash and voting for a zoning change or delivering a verdict the way the bagman and the briber wanted it. It is much more complex. You got to think it through. And the judge, Harry Leinenweber, himself a former lawmaker who actually was in the legislature at the same time Mike McLean was.
Well, he served 10 years with McLean and Madigan, didn't he?
He did. He served 10 years, and he served at almost the exact same time as McLean. Yeah. And so he also said that a lot of his decisions are going to probably be scrutinized by an appellate court. And when you noted this is a Seventh Circuit, it's a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. So there have been rulings that the defense definitely will argue that have been made in other appeals courts, federal appeals courts, that they will probably say, most likely will say, should nix these convictions. And so that could take this up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, will a Supreme Court that has such a majority, a large majority of Republicans, take the case up even, is another question there too. So politics are just laced into this case through and through.
We mentioned that this is being appealed, these convictions. Of course, we are also awaiting a trial next year involving the former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. And Ray, how does this, for people that don't follow this a lot, how does this play into Madigan's pending trial? I would think it's not good news for the former House Speaker.
Yeah, I don't think that they were probably standing up and cheering when they heard this verdict. A lot of their arguments are going to be the same. This case that Madigan is involved with also involves Mike McLean, who was convicted in this ComEd 4 case. Madigan and McLean are accused of racketeering, and they will have to go through some of the same points that were made in this case, this ComEd 4 case, because it's all the same scheme. Now, it'll be coming at it from a different direction, but with Madigan, for example, he will be having to explain why or did he create an atmosphere that made special interests, or in this case, ComEd, feel that they had to put people on the payroll in no work jobs because they didn't want to make him mad. And that will be part of the equation. But there is also a similar but smaller case involving the Illinois affiliate of AT&T that has a similar arrangement where they put on a basically little or no work job Representative Eddie Acevedo, former Representative Eddie Acevedo. Acevedo, of course, is has already spent 6 months in prison because he was convicted as an offshoot of this case. He pled guilty and went to prison for tax evasion. But this new case will be complicated, and a lot of the arguments that they probably thought they could make and convince a jury will have to be studied and recalibrated.
Yeah, Charlie, you're not a lawyer, but your thoughts on Madigan, does he have a chance to win a case based on a lot of the same evidence, like Ray was saying, that was presented at this trial?
Yeah, I think there's always a chance. I mean, the White Sox aren't eliminated yet. But it's, for example, what we talked about, the rulings in other circuits. Supposing the U.S. Supreme Court takes up one of those appeals and really narrowly defines what is illegal and says it's not enough to try and influence people by favors. There has to be a tangible exchange of money, something of value. And as the attorney pointed out, the value in this case wasn't in dollars, but it was in the political capital it gave Madigan. One thing I mentioned in past discussions, in past weeks, it occurred to me that what Madigan cultivated at ComEd or with ComEd was sort of like a modern version of the old patronage system. After some of the court rulings that shut down traditional patronage, where I get a job at Streets and Sand, but my job is to go out and talk to voters, those are now illegal, and there's a lot of scrutiny on those. So in a sense, Madigan set up this alternate patronage operation with ComEd and with ComEd's connivance, if you will. And go ahead.
Well, yeah, and McLean was even caught on tape explaining it like that. He said, well, you know, ComEd used to give the 13th Ward, which is Madigan's ward, where he is still committeeman, you know, maybe 5 meter readers that they could put on the payroll, name 5 people who could read meter readers. Well, the jobs now, because of some of this legislation that passed, actually, and computerized a lot of the old groundwork jobs that were the bottom line blue collar jobs, are no longer there. So they started going into this more, if you want to call it sophisticated, situation where they put people on the payroll to through a third party. And they thought, and you can almost see how they were thinking it. They were thinking, well, this is arm's length from this, and this is arm's length from that. Well, it'll never blow back on us. And
John Hooker and McLean were even talking about how this, it's all clean. If there's anything, if anybody wants to question whether these Madigan allies are doing any work, they can ask Jay Doherty about it, because he's the one who was paying them through the contract. But ComEd was sending money to them. And that's another element that you don't want to overlook. There was $1.3 million in subcontracts that were sent by ComEd to Madigan allies. They weren't sent to Madigan allies because they just picked these Madigan allies out of the blue. They were there because they were the top precinct captains and former aldermen, and in the case of Acevedo, a former member of Madigan's leadership team.
Well, Charlie, what does this mean in your mind for state government? I mean, this is, we know what it means for the people who were on trial and Madigan no longer in political office here in Springfield, but what does it mean for state government? Because it seems like every time there is a scandal and after a conviction, we always say, well, this is going to change things. Do you think this changes things?
At the risk of sounding like a cynic, not very much. There will be maybe some tweaks around the edges, but I don't think there's going to be any dramatic passage of a whole ton of new ethics legislation. It was interesting because our colleague, Dave McKinney at WBEZ, did an interview with Joe Ferguson, the former inspector general for Chicago, and he had a whole bunch of stuff that he thought should be done. He thinks there should be a statewide grand jury under the attorney general to explore public corruption cases. I can tell you right now that'll never happen. The idea has been broached in past years, and it was always the fear of the Democrats, if a Republican is elected attorney general, it'll become a partisan thing. And vice versa, the Republicans, if there's a Democrat attorney general, they'll come after Republicans. So that's the non-starter. He says we should tighten the conflict of interest laws. We should expand the revolving door prohibition about retiring legislators leaving office and then within a matter of couple months becoming lobbyists. And he also questioned, why should Mike McLean continue drawing a state pension despite these convictions? So the ideas are there, but I don't think they're going to draw much traction. And I think part of it is there are bigger things on the people's plates. And I don't see this conviction as being a political windfall for the Republican Party for a couple of reasons. One is they've been bashing Mike Madigan for like a decade. So this should come as no surprise to people who bought into the Republican idea that Mike Madigan is Darth Vader reincarnated. And secondly, who is going to be the head of the ticket for the Republican Party when we finally get around to voting in November 2024? There's a chance that it could be former President Donald Trump, who actually pardoned the governor who got the longest prison term for corruption, Rod Blagojevich. So if Trump is the nominee, the ability to use ethics against the Democrats, I think, is going to be severely undercut.
Your thoughts on that, Ray? You've covered lots of scandals through the years in state government.
Lawmakers are allergic to real reform. They just don't want anything that could possibly catch them up in official misconduct. The official misconduct statute, which is a misdemeanor, is so full of holes that you could drive a truck through it, to use an old phrase. But the reality is they just don't want to change things. They'll say, well, we did a whole bunch of things and we did a big reform. And the reality is it's not much. But they will criticize the criticizers then and try to stand their ground.
Before we leave this subject, Ray, why don't you give us a couple of things that really stood out to you from this trial?
Well, a couple of things, Sean, that we didn't have a chance to really highlight, but I thought it was interesting when Ann Promajori, the former ComEd CEO, was on the stand. She said that Madigan wanted ComEd employees, or suggested that ComEd employees be used to go out and campaign for his Democratic troops. And she said she stood up to him and said no. Now, that was one of the examples that she was giving to say that, you know, she didn't go along with Madigan on all of his requests, et cetera. And she also had argued, Sean, that she didn't know anything about this subcontractor situation, even though it was being run out of her own CEO budget. And the jurors said afterwards that they didn't buy that at all. She's a smart woman. She has a law degree. She clerked for a federal judge, and she didn't remember any of this. It's hard to believe. They also found it was hard to believe John Hooker saying that when he and McLean were talking about how they created this subcontractor program, and that was caught on tape, that he was just joshing around. This is not something that sat well with the jury, as your early quote said. The other thing that was curious that came out during Promajori's testimony was that she said this whole idea that this was going on was just something that she would not have allowed, and we weren't bribing Mike Madigan. She said that flatly.
Well, let's move on. We've talked about the former Illinois House Speaker. Well, what about the current Illinois House Speaker? He was in the news some this week. A story by our colleague Alex Degman talked about how employees in the House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch's office have declared their intent to unionize, and they've cited some grievances like low pay and also what they call a confusing compensatory time off policy, some other issues as well there. Charlie, I don't recall this coming up before. Maybe it has, but this is legislative staff. A lot of people who listen to this show may be familiar with staff, may have even worked on staff. We know that they work a lot of hours, often for not a lot of money. Let me get your thoughts on this story here and what might come of it, if anything.
Well, I found it interesting because as the staffers who are asking to unionize pointed out, they do work terrible hours during the session. They're there from dawn until dark, and then some. The lawmakers might go home at midnight. The staff is there overnight. They don't get paid very well. They don't get very good benefits. And I think a lot of them are there and seeing this as an opportunity to be on the staff, make some connections, put in 2 years, you know, working their tails off out in the bean fields, in the hopes that a couple of years down the road, they can become a lobbyist or they can become some other higher paid position. And one of the interesting things is apparently it's unclear whether or not these staff people actually can form a union. And part of it is because, as I understand it, the state law that authorizes union formations, the Illinois Labor Relations Board, does not have authority over General Assembly employees. And I thought it was disingenuous for Speaker Welch to say, and his staff was saying, oh yeah, we support our guys, but we want them to go through the formal process. And the union leaders are saying, what the heck? We've already got like 90% of our folks saying, yes, we want to have a union. Why do we have to go through another vote? So it'd be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, and Ray, this is a General Assembly that is heavily supported by a lot of unions. The Democrats control the General Assembly, so it puts Welch and possibly others in the General Assembly in some very interesting territory here when it comes to this issue, doesn't it?
Yeah, you just mentioned that the lawmakers, especially obviously the Democrats, have support from big union leaders. Now, big union leaders who rely on the staff to scramble and pull their analyses together of their various bills are going to have to say to the lawmakers, yeah, this is not a bad idea to have your people that you don't want to be unionized. So it's also kind of against what Democrats believe, where you ought to be able to get the type of pay that you deserve for type of work that you do.
Charlie, there's only about a minute left here, and I know it's not enough time to talk in great detail about this. We will talk more in coming shows as we get closer to the end of the legislative session, but there was some news this week that came out about a revenue estimate. This was from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. Not necessarily good news for the state.
No, and to wrap it up really succinctly, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which are the fiscal gurus for the General Assembly, revised its current year budget forecast by $728 million. So the amount of money a month ago they thought the state was going to take in the fiscal year that ends June 30th, now they're dropping it by $728 million.
That's huge.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, surprising, right?
And Charlie, what was the reasoning behind this?
Nonetheless, so their FY23 estimate is only about $183 million below what the governor's Office of Management and Budget estimated, on which the governor's budget proposal for the coming fiscal year was predicated. What it does mean, though, is there's not going to be much room with a current year surplus beyond the spending that is already there to be able to put more money into all these programs. And there's a couple billion dollars worth of asks for this year and next year hanging out there.
Let's go now to our notes from the field, and Ray, we'll start with you.
I've been in the courtroom for the last 8 weeks here, Sean, so I'm just going to tell you that what we saw here in this courtroom was not just your average courtroom attorneys. We had what I've called basically the Thrilla and Manila of courtroom lawyers here boxing it out. And so it will be interesting to see when this goes to appeal, whether they can get any sway on a Seventh Circuit that has not generally reversed itself heavily on major issues like this that will come before it. And so I'm really curious as to how this will play out in the coming years.
All right. And Charlie.
Well, one of the pieces of legislation that passed just the other day is a measure that would block libraries in the state from receiving state grants if they ban books and if they don't follow the sort of the guidance of the American Library Association. And this is a bill proposed by Secretary of State Alexei Janulis, who is also the state librarian and whose office administers grant programs for public and school libraries. And it's in reaction to the number of, I would say, conservative groups that are protesting the books that are available in public libraries. And they say, we want these books out of there. The American Library Association said that last year there were roughly 1,300 demands for books and other resources to remove, the largest number of attempted book bans in more than 20 years.
Well, we'll continue to follow that bill as well, now headed to the governor. That's all the time we have for State Week. Our panel included Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune and Charlie Wheeler. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app and iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.